Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. Crystal Mack has led several lives, most recently that of a pastry chef and business owner. Crystal is the owner of Black Sugar Bakery, which she has described as a food and lifestyle concept from the Black feminine perspective. Black Sugar serves up treats like macarons, lavender honey pie, and activated charcoal brownies, in addition to teas and other desserts. Before opening Black Sugar, Crystal was riding a tricycle around the city, selling pies and ice pops as the owner of Pie Cycle and Karma Pop. At the time of this recording, Black Sugar was located in Our House, a food hall that opened last year in Baltimore's Remington neighborhood. But Crystal has since left Our House and is laying plans for the business's next move. She talked about that decision and about the confidence it takes to step away from the things she loves. Crystal also discussed appropriation, the intersection of identity and business, and why she started baking. Here's our conversation. Did you grow up in Baltimore?
Yes and no. So I went to sleep every night in Essex, but I spent my days as a kid in the Northwood and Hamilton areas of Baltimore. So I went to elementary school at a private school across from Good Samaritan Hospital. It's called Emmanuel Lutheran. It's now just a Lutheran church. It's no longer a school, I believe. But I went to school there with my sister and my cousins, and it was around the corner from Morgan. When I say Morgan State University, or Morgan University now. And my mother was a teacher for the Baltimore City Public School System. The school was Chinquapin Middle School. It's now closed, and it wasn't too far from Belvedere Square. So I had early memories of Belvedere Square, all of that, York Road, Govins, all of that in my childhood. So those are the things that I remember a lot from growing up in Baltimore. And then it was a very weird contrast to spend my days there and my evenings there somewhat, and then come back to Essex, which was very, very white. And I say that because it was the 90s, and you know, it was a lot of Black power going on, a lot of hip hop that was very much Black power. You know, you had A Different World on TV, you had The Cosby Show on TV, and, you know, my dad was finishing up school at a historically Black university, and we were just very, very much an empowered Black family. So for me, it was just interesting, other than on TV, I'd never really had any interactions with white people. Even when I lived in a white neighborhood, we were the only Black family in my neighborhood. So it was a very, I knew early on, I understood the segregation of Baltimore as a whole, regardless of the county or the city. And I learned how to operate within that, if that makes any sense, or understand the subtle nuances or microaggressions or just differences in culture. I remember when I actually started to go to school in the county in Essex, I went to the middle school in the county because my parents wanted us to just have that, I'm going to come home on my own and, have my own key and stuff like that kind of thing, experience. I remember there only being five Black kids in my class. When I went to school before, it was always all Black. So to me, it was just whoa.
Did people treat you differently?
Yes. I remember being treated differently by the Black girls at my school. And I also remember being treated differently by the white kids at my school. The Black girls at my school, a lot of times they'd be we lived in the neighborhood. And I should also preface, we lived in a single family split level home community in Essex, which it wasn't very fancy, but I guess to the people that lived in Essex that were Black, it was very fancy. And yeah, they just thought that we were I was rich, or I was a snob, or, you know, and I wasn't a snob. I was very much a friendly person. I've always been a friendly person. But I guess it was just that I came from another world that they couldn't relate to. And I couldn't relate to their world. And even the white kids in my neighborhood that I came to know and that I went to school with, they still treated me differently in that I was Black, and not even in a negative way, but it was just they couldn't fully connect because they didn't really understand certain things. Just I didn't understand certain things. I didn't even know what going down to the ocean meant. or going
down the ocean.
Down the ocean. They were like, yeah, I remember them being like, oh, we're going down the ocean this weekend. Or we went down, and I was like, Atlantic Ocean? And they were like, no, Ocean City. And I was like, what? Like, how have I never heard of Ocean City? But again, like, me not understanding, I've never heard of Ocean City just because I grew up in, even though I was living in Essex, I grew up in this, like, very Black middle-class community of people in, like, Northwood and stuff where we don't really, Black people didn't really go to Ocean City like that. that's not really much a Black Baltimore thing. So I remember having this, like, dying obsession in middle school, like, begging my mother, like, we have to go to Ocean City. And I remember we went, and it was nothing but Confederate flags everywhere, and we were the only Black family, and my mother was like, you want to go here? and just like, well, take it in. This is why we don't go. Like, not even this is why we don't go, but it's just like, you know. And honestly, every experience I've had, I've tried to give Ocean City a shot with an open mind. Every time I've gone down there, it was always some type of like underlying racial tension. Even the last time I went, the whole experience was great. I was like, wow, what a great day. Like, this is a great trip. And then at the end of the trip, we were like packing up the car. And there was a drunken lady in the street going on about all the Black people on the beach. Obviously, she didn't say the Black people on the beach. She used another word. But like, she was clearly drunk, and she got arrested by the police for drunken intoxication or public intoxication. But yeah, it was just like, ugh. It's like, okay, I'm going to go. I'm like, all right, you know what? I feel like a, quote, Marylander now. Like, I'm truly Baltimore. Yeah. I went to Ocean City, and I did not feel uncomfortable for 1 minute. And then I left, and I was just like, okay, not everything is for you, girl. You just going to have to suck it up as a loss.
Well, besides, like, the Ocean City fixation, uh-huh. I feel like, you know, when you're a kid, whatever makes you different.
Yeah, you want to, like, you want to overcome that.
Yeah, you just want to push it aside. So growing up in, like, what you said, and in a Black empowered family, did you ever, like, kind of want to reject that and, like, you know, do, like, the white mainstream stuff, anything like that, reject, you know, what your family, what was important to your family?
No, because it was just who I was. And I think even in the beginning, like, it was just, even we did have like one or two white kids at school, at my private school. And even with that, like, when the other kids would pick on them just because they were different, I would just be like, leave them alone. You know, they're not really different from us. They're not any different. I think that's one thing that I've never really had a feeling of needing to shed my Blackness or be more mainstream, quote, or more white mainstream. And I think that's actually why I have such a wide range of friends. I think a lot of people, because I had that instilled in me at such an early age, that sense of pride and understanding that because I'm Black and certain things may not be given to me or may not be seen in a certain light, or I may be having more struggles in my life than my white counterparts or other people of color with different struggles than I have as a Black person, I begin to learn at an early age the intersectionality of Blackness and understanding that, you know, being Black means a myriad of things. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, constantly like rocking the kente cloth and constantly, you know, it means a number of different things to a number of people. And I don't feel the need to constantly protest that I am a Black woman. I think it's already, you know, it's already been determined for me that I'm a Black woman. Even if I wanted to deny it, I couldn't. There's no way I could live in the world without that being a fact and a reality. But fortunately for me, I love being Black, and I love that, you know, it's such a beautiful thing. And I think that how can I say this? I think that the fact that I had an early understanding of, like I said, the intersectionality of Blackness, I never felt like I had to be one type of Black person or one type of way. So for instance, like, if I'm, you know, listening to like Christina Aguilera or listening to like NSYNC and stuff or whatever, any like mainstream, like bubbly bubblegum pop in middle school, none of the like Black girls that I went to school with were really listening to that. So they're like, oh, you white? You like that white girl music? I'm like, girl, I like music. Bye. Like, I just didn't care. You know, I never cared because I knew that was not what determined my Blackness. Because if that was the case, that means that because there's a white girl next to me listening to all the hip hop under the sun, she's Blacker than me. And that's false. So I'm not. I don't tie my Blackness to
to certain things. But that being said, I do want people to respect and appreciate my culture and not put it on as a costume and not think that because they are, you know, versed in a song or hang with a bunch of people of a certain race or, you know, that they can appropriate hairstyles, appropriate vernacular, appropriate traditions that are typically from the African diaspora or Black Americans. We got real heavy in race. I'm so sorry.
Don't apologize.
But I mean, it just comes out naturally, I guess.
Well, I think I've seen you describe the business you own, Black Sugar, as a business and lifestyle brand from a Black female perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really interesting in a business context. I was hoping you could tell me more about why it's important for you to integrate identity into business.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the reasons I'm sitting here with you today, because I've done that. A lot of people think that I shouldn't be expressing personal opinions through my brand. I shouldn't be expressing or I shouldn't be commingling like my brand with myself. But for me, I am my brand. I am who I am. And that is very much a part of what Black Sugar is. And honestly, from the beginning, it didn't start as that. I know it is now, though. It evolved into something even more beautiful than I could have imagined it to be. It did not start as a lifestyle or food concept from the Black feminine perspective. It just started out as me loving the color black. And having and being like, I want something cool and contemporary. What's the opposite of white? Black. I love black, and sugar is white, but I also love Japanese sugar. It's called there's a Japanese sugar from Okinawa. It's called Black Sugar, and it comes in this like solidified black bar, very rich and earthy in flavor. And to me, I was like, oh, that would be cool, Black Sugar.
It reminds me kind of like an edgier brown sugar.
Right,
or
and
something.
That is exactly what it is. It's an edgier brown sugar. That's a perfect description. And when I went into the meeting with developers of our house, and they're like, all right, can't be Pie Cycle anymore because we want everyone to come with a new concept. So what's your name going to be? And I was like, yeah, it's going to be Black Sugar. And they were all like, oh. And I was like, why are they going, oh? And I was like, oh, because I'm black and they think it's about being black. I was like, oh, Lord. Okay, let me take control of the situation before they even like try to change it in their own way. Not that they would, because it's my concept, but I didn't want it to be framed around race through their perspective. And I was like, let me just control this now. So that ended up being me going on a journey in my own way, unknowingly, to be happy and empowered as a black woman in the culinary industry. I feel like in a city that's 65% black, I know a number of black female chefs. I know a number of black female cooks, bakers, and I don't see them ever. All I ever see is me, and that's not okay. And it's not that they aren't in existence. It's that for some reason, people don't think the quality of work is up to par, or they would never go to the neighborhood where this chef is cooking or baking. So they don't get the opportunity or the privilege to taste what these people are creating. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, I think that I'm very happy and blessed to be in the position that I'm in, to have people looking at me, to be sitting here again with you today. But I think it goes into a bigger conversation of, okay, it's not just me, though. Like, it's more people out here really doing the work, too. And they were doing the work before I even started doing the work.
Well, and the conversation around appropriation, which you brought up, is, it seems to be really prevalent in the culinary community now as well. And it's like, if you see, you know, like another glowing profile of like a white male chef in Washington who comes out with like a new pho place, and it's like he's reinventing pho.
I don't know.
I feel like I just see that on
That happens all the time. It happens all the time. So, and I mean, and even with that, so with Black Sugar, we try to expose people to a number of different cultures and cuisines. Primarily what we've been focusing on in our calendar year of being open was Filipino food. I have a love for Filipino food. I have a love for the Filipino community. And I think of, when I think of the history of the Philippines and what they've kind of gone through as far as like their relationship with America is very problematic. just the history behind that. So if you want to look into do some research before you go to like Bad Saint or something, just so you can have a true appreciation of the culture and the food and the people, because it's a very beautiful people with beautiful food. But I like to take inspiration and add that into the flavors of my food. So I'm not saying, I discovered ube. This is a purple yam, and I discovered it. And no, you didn't hear of it before me because I came up with it. which I feel a lot of people are, you know, that's the situation or the conversation with these white chefs or these white male chefs. They're not really giving the background story of how this came to be or where the inspiration came from. It's very vague. No one really knows. And, you know, if you ask them, they'll be like, oh, you know, I just travel and like the traveling in the world speaks to me. And that's it. It's never like, oh, well, you should look at these people and look into their culture. So with that, when Black Sugar came to be and I had the opportunity to have a physical space, I have a number of things on my menu that are influenced by flavors of the Philippines. So I have, most importantly, or most, I guess, most enjoyed or most recognized is the toasted coconut and ube croissant. It is a almond pastry cream croissant with ube, which is a purple yam. It's very popular in Filipino cuisine. And that has drawn actually a large number of Filipino people to my shop. And I didn't really realize that we had a large Filipino community in Baltimore, but we do. We have a strong one. And I ended up actually doing a kumain with a well-known Filipino chef. Her name is Yana Gilbueno. We've become great friends. So we had a traditional Filipino style kumain with the banana leaves outside, all stretched out on the table. Everyone was eating with their hands. It was a really beautiful communal dinner. And then we also did another pop-up a few months following that. It was a halo-halo pop-up. So we had a ube and cheddar cheese ice cream, which is a traditional flavor of ice cream, very popular in the Philippines, cheddar cheese ice cream. So ube cheddar cheese ice cream and a like Rice Krispie Treat taco shell with preserved fruits and palm nuts. And it was just really beautiful. And even in that, that was a perfect example of how to properly honor or show appreciation to another culture that you are not a part of. I did not know how to do that. That's something that I'm not familiar with. It's not my culture. I invited another chef in to have an opportunity to share her cuisine in the proper way with audience. And I think even if you Googled, if anyone's listening out there and you're on your computer, Google Bon Appetit Halo Halo. They did a horrible job of Halo Halo, their interpretation of Halo Halo. Even in the writing, it was just very disrespectful. It was like, yeah, take some ice cream and throw some gummy bears on it, put some granola. It was just like, it was almost like they were just like, yeah, it's just a hot mess anyway. It literally translates to mess, so why not? Just go for it. And it was very disrespectful, but I do think that they did a good job of like saying, hey, we messed up, and they still have it live on their website so people can see like, yeah, we messed up. Like, this is what we said. But that's just a perfect example of, you know, even if they thought they were paying respect to something, it was just very much disrespectful. So I felt like in my position that I was in, being at our house, being one of the few only or the only worker-owned, minority-owned, woman-owned business at our house, I felt like it was my responsibility or my opportunity to give other communities and chefs of other cultures an opportunity to come into a space that is mostly white and share their cuisine in their own way, in their own voice, and not have it discovered by some chef that thinks it's cool all of a sudden, you know. Because for a long time, we were shamed as Black people for soul food. And now it's like called farm to table, and it's hot, and it's cool. I mean, if I was eating Scrapple, and I've been eating Scrapple since I was a kid, like now it's cool to eat Scrapple, you know, so or it's cool to eat pig feet. It's cool to eat pig ears. I've been eating that for the longest time and was shamed for it for a long time. And now because it's been validated by a community of people that I may not necessarily relate to financially, racially, gender wise, whatever, it's really unfortunate. So I feel like in my power of having a voice at this time, I want to kind of take the reins back on the conversation and be like, no.
What were you doing before Black Sugar?
Before Black Sugar, I was working, technically, before Black Sugar, up to the very moment before Black Sugar opened, I was Grubhub driving. And I was also walking dogs, like months before Black Sugar opened. Prior to that, I was working at Warby Parker, the operations manager. And I was also riding around on the Pie Cycle, which is Baltimore's first food vending tricycle. And on that, I sold pies. I also sold my Karma Pops, which are farm to stick ice pops that focus on mid-Atlantic seasonality. So we have very interesting flavors in the popsicles, and we work mostly with minority-owned, women-owned, or urban-based farms.
Does the tricycle still go around, or are you just all black sugar?
Well, right now it's black sugar, but the tricycle will be making an appearance soon.
Ooh, you heard it here first.
Yeah, it's coming out soon. So I have a few Karma Pop events lined up, and by the time you're listening to this, black sugar will be out of our house. And I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited about it. It was a great opportunity while I had it, but I think that it's time for black sugar to grow in a more sustainable and equitable way. Right now, I have the smallest stall at our house. It's 164 square feet. So I split that stall with Pete and Martin of Little Baby's Ice Cream. So truly, I have 92 square feet of space that I am currently paying $18.55 a month for. That does not make sense to me. As much as I enjoy being in an up-and-coming neighborhood of Baltimore, whatever that means, I think that this was an opportunity for me to try out and see. I'm thinking of it as an extended pop-up, and it was nice for me to see that people were into what I was doing, are into what I'm doing, and now I can kind of worry about doing that on my own. For the longest time, I think I was concerned about, was it me or was it the tricycle? Right? Because it's like, is it the like cool draw of the tricycle, or is it what I'm doing? Are people buying into what I'm doing? And they were buying into what I was doing. And I'm really glad that I took the chance at our house and took out the loans and found the grant money and all of that. But now I know that I'm ready to move on to the next step, whatever that may be. And right now, the next step is a ton of catering that I have lined up, and also still doing Uber Eats, still doing Amazon Eats, all of that stuff we're still going to be doing out of the stall, but just no more actual physical presence. So if someone wants to order something, they can do it on our online website through a number of vendors that I hope to have soon. I know that Trove will be carrying our baked goods, and then also through Uber Eats. Or they can send a direct order to our email and we can process that. But I think for me, just going from a scrappy street vendor to like a real, and I hate to say real because I was a boss before, but a real boss now with employees that I have to be responsible for, I think that's just a whole level of stress that kind of takes away from the funness of baking. You know, I was managing two businesses. I was baking full time for one, and I was burning out. I am burnt out. Like, I know now that I know that the end is near for me being in a physical space day to day, 7 days a week, maybe 10 to 12 hours a day. I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited to read a book. I'm really excited to take a pottery class. I'm really excited to travel. I'm really excited to take cooking classes. I'm really excited to be teaching workshops. All of these things that I have lined up in the coming months. I have a very full schedule up until October, and I'm really excited about it. But it's a schedule that I had control over, and it's a schedule that wasn't really dictated by the day-to-day flow of business, which is something that I've really had to struggle with. I'm so used to like getting up and going, and that's the fun part of being a mobile business entrepreneur or business owner, which is what I was before Black Sugar. I did everything from the trike. When I wanted to do it, I would do bike party. I was out in the community with everyone, but I felt so restricted and like held back in this one space. And those opportunities would still come around. They'd be like, hey, can you do this? Can you do that? And even when the opportunities would come to me, bike party came to our house one night, like ended at our house. And I could not get away from the stall to even like enjoy it or whip out the tricycle and like sell stuff in the garage with them. And that's a big jump from going to riding from the beginning point to the end point with them on a tricycle to not even being able to like be a part. It really sucks because they help get me where I am right now. So sorry, that's where I was before. I was mobile before. And prior to that, and those I should mention because that is important to the story of how I came to be where I am. The Pie Cycle and Karma Pop were Kickstarter-backed businesses. So I did a Kickstarter while I was working on the line at Le Garage as garde-manger there. And I got funded. It was $7,000, I believe. And yeah, I got funded and things kind of like took off from there. And I've had a number of like great opportunities, a number of great collaborations, and I made a number of like really great friends.
And you were, I wasn't able to get my hands on a copy yet because they don't run their stories online, but I only recently found out you were profiled in Cherry Bomb.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so cool. That's like, I love the photography. I love that magazine. Oh, my God. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love Cherry Bomb. Actually, I am going to be going up to New York tomorrow to spend some time with some women that I met at Jubilee. They are... That's just a great community to be in. Those women, I mean, now that we're listening to a podcast, like a woman-centric podcast, those women are very supportive. And I know that when I was up baking at like 2 a.m., I'd be listening to Cherry Bomb Radio, and I was like, one day I will be like that. I'll be like truly fulfilled, and I can like tell someone about it. And then I ended up going to Jubilee and like telling everyone about it at Jubilee. And it was, I think 500, not 500. That's a lot of people. That's crazy. I think I want to say like 200 people were in attendance. But I got to share a little bit of my story and a little bit of background on PieCycle and my time in AmeriCorps at Real Food Farm, and how I was able to kind of sustain the business while on food stamps through AmeriCorps. And all of that is in the issue, not to like plug, but it's in the issue. You can find it at Trove or Atomic Books or Barnes & Noble. But yeah, and it's just been really amazing, an amazing community of women that have been very supportive with the success of Black Sugar and supportive with like personal struggles. My father recently passed and I got nothing but support from them with that. So yeah, it was just surreal and crazy to be sitting next to someone like Julia Tertian and having like a normal conversation with her.
I love small victories.
Oh my goodness.
I'm not like a big cook, and but I don't have many cookbooks, but it's amazing for that exact reason.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty much a beginner and I love her.
That's why I love small victories, because it's about the small victories.
Yeah.
Like, yes, I did this.
I'm like, wow, I made like one meatball. Yeah. Like, I don't ever have to cook again. This is such a big deal for me. Yeah.
So I will actually be seeing her tomorrow. So that's cool. But yeah, it's a really great community of women. And that's how I met Yana Gilbuena, who was the chef that we did the Kamayan with. Just real people that want to build community around food. And yeah, I'm really happy that I've met them, and I really hope that we can kind of bring some of that Cherry Bomb energy to the food scene here in Baltimore with women. We have a lot of women food-ready product makers that are doing stuff, like
Michelle Scrinola,
yeah,
Michelle, who was on this podcast.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Yes. Yeah, so Michelle, we did a popsicle collaboration with Karma Pop maybe about literally a year ago, I think. Yeah. It was a yoga retreat thing, yoga workout in the morning with the healthy pops. So yeah, we have a lot of women food maker businesses that I feel like whenever I've needed some support from them or I've had a question, they've always been really supportive. Barbara from Neapol is like super supportive to me. She's awesome. Katie and Marie of Kinderhook, they were awesome. Yeah, so I hope that we can continue that here in Baltimore. And they're actually coming down, Cherry Bomb. They're going to be coming down in October to do a live recording. And also, I'm hoping to curate another marketplace, another Black Market marketplace, and it'll be at Trove. So it'll be more women food maker focused. So there'll be more sampling, not so much selling. So you can sample all of a number of women's food that they make.
How did you start baking?
Stress. I just wanted something fun and hands-on to do. I'm a very like hands-on person. I used to be in the aesthetics field, which is skincare. So I worked in the spa. I was a body waxer. I was facials, all of that, body wraps. My job mostly consisted of eyebrow waxes, Brazilian waxes, and facials. So I was very hands-on all the time.
The most hands-on.
Nothing like freaks me out really about the human body at all. So yeah, I started with that. And then I was kind of feeling like, okay, I'm getting a little stunted here. I was recommended to apply for a position in New York with Red Door Spa, which was the spa I was currently at the time. And I was going through the interview process. Everything was going really well. And then it came down to the getting money to move, the relocation stipend, and no one was trying to give me any money. And I think that really bummed me out about that was that I had been with the company, I think at that time, for 3 years, and weekly I had done thousands of dollars in services for them and maybe saw a third of that, and I'd only asked for $1,000, and they were like, we just can't give you that right now. And I was like, what? I know a facial costs like $300. You can't give me $1,000? And that was me lowballing because I was like, I don't know. So that made me feel like I wasn't really invested in as an employee. I was a really great employee. I was one of their most requested estheticians. And that just kind of bummed me out. And that was one of my goals. It was like, okay, I'm going to be a Red Door esthetician when I was in school. And I got there and I did it. But then I was like, oh, this is it. Okay. Well, what else do I really love to do? I love comedy. And I was like, well, what did I want to do as a kid? That's kind of what I went back to when I was feeling like lost, I guess, in my career. And it was like, well, I always wanted to be on Saturday Night Live.
So just like, go sign up, yeah, and you'll get on SNL.
Yeah, and I was like, I'm going to take improv classes. So I took improv classes to kind of like get out excess emotion and like laugh. And I made some really awesome friends. And then after that, I was just kind of like, oh, what else do I want to do? Ended up leaving aesthetics and starting to work at Le Garage. I was one of the people that helped open Le Garage. And while I was there, it was definitely very much like an awakening into like kitchen culture. Everyone there for the most part was pretty cool. I did have a few interactions that in hindsight now I see the bigger picture of what they were. A lot of them were like very sexist, like down, like talking down to me because I'm a woman and I wouldn't know any better about something because I'm a woman, or because I have no formal training, or, you know, another female chef feeling like she had to like knock me down in order to show the guys that she was just like one of them, you know, so she could get respected, even though in the end that's not what would happen. So there's that too. It was just something that made me realize I was early in my food journey and I was like, is this what I want to do? What do I want to do? I'm like, well, I don't even know if I want to be in the kitchen or if I want to be seen as a chef, but I do need these skills and I don't have school money. So I'm going to work here and I'm going to pick up skills. And I picked up some skills like simple light pickling and making sauces like ketchup from scratch and stuff like that. Plating, desserts, baking. But yeah, and even with that, I was baking a little bit prior to being a garde manger. I was just baking at home. So before I started working there, I was baking at home after work at the spa. And I was also mostly focusing on pops too. I was making a lot of popsicles after work at the spa and then bringing them into the spa for my coworkers and being like, what do you think? You like this? And they're like, yeah, these are good. So there was that. And then when I left the spa, I was still continuing the pop practice. I was still continuing with that practice. And then also working on my at-home pastry skills as far as like making panna cottas, making, I guess, like fine desserts. Like pâté de fruits, which for the longest time I was pronouncing as pâté de fruit, just because I did not go to school. And I still catch myself to this day. There are things that I say that because I didn't go to school, everything I've learned honestly has been from YouTube or a workshop or me just trying it out or stodging somewhere. So there are a lot of things like I literally just learned financier this year. Calling it financier. What can I say? I don't know. But I can make one. I can still make
it. That's what's more important.
It doesn't matter if I don't know how to pronounce it. I can make it, though, and it'll be delicious. And you'll be like, oh, I love your financier. And I'm like, oh.
Oh, that's what you love.
That's what you love.
I mean, in what ways do you think your lack of formal training have been an advantage or a disadvantage?
I'm willing to, you know, play around a little bit more. And I feel like I'm more dedicated to learning something. And I feel like there's more of a sense of accomplishment when I do it because no one helped me. The disadvantage, obviously, like from the jump, not being respected because you don't have that skill set. And also there are things that, like, it sucks. Like, I want to be able to make, like, a crème, or I'm sure I can learn how to make that. But it's a lot of things that intimidate me because I don't have that formal training. For the longest time, I was intimidated by grams, like measuring grams. I think that's the true difference between a home cook and a professional cook, that gram, cup, teaspoon measurement system. And even till this day, I go back and forth between the two. I have a scale. I just like to use a quick cup. but I just go back and forth. So for time and cost purposes, grams are better. But for fun, spur of the moment idea things, sometimes a cup is better or no cup is better. Just a pinch or a handful of things is better. And in my doing that, I feel like I'm kind of honoring all the home cooks out there, honoring my grandmother, other people who didn't really like use cups like that. And it still was delicious.
Your grandmother was a good cook?
She was a cook. She was more of a cake person. And I know that she was not a big fan of people who had flavorless cakes. Like if they didn't add extract to their cakes, that was just like she hated a flavorless cake. Yeah, that sweet potato pie, which is like Black family staple, that was like my first experience with baking was sweet potato pie. And even after that, I remember we used to go to, I think it was Hamilton Bakery that had a lemon meringue pie that everybody was like, oh, lemon meringue pie. But we were very much that family that was very much into Baltimore food culture. Like we love like chicken from Lexington Market, strawberry shortcake from Hess Bakery, like just very much into that. And even with that, though, we did still bake at home. You know, I have those early home memories of being in the kitchen at my grandparents' house and like playing with pots and pans and all of that. But she was more on the savory side of things. And yeah, like definitely more on the savory side of things. Like, and my grandfather was just like Southern boy that like loved hoghead cheese and all that other stuff. So, you know, like I said, I got introduced to that stuff early on. I was kind of grossed out as a kid, like, what is that? When they tell you it's pig feet, you're like, I don't want it. But then when you eat it, you're like, oh, pig's feet aren't that bad. They're kind of delicious. So,
yeah. When something you enjoy or when a passion becomes your work, and then when you open a business devoted to it, I mean, you talked about being burnt out. Do you lose any of the love for creating?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. It makes you reevaluate a lot, especially if you dedicated your whole life to it, which is what I've done. I mean, I've given up, this might sound horrible, I've given up friendships, I've given up relationships that were good or bad, that did not serve me or my vision for my work. I've given up a lot of things to be where I am today. But yeah, I think if you are truly dedicated to whatever it is that you are dedicated to, you owe it to yourself and to that thing to step away for a moment, which is what I am doing. Step away for a moment and really remember why you loved it, and then remember and try to like play with that a little bit. And if you remember why you loved it and you're playing with that a little bit, then you can fall back in love with it again. It's just like any marriage. Like I'm pretty sure there are ups and downs in any marriage, you know, but you do the work that you need to do to make sure that, you know, you're still in it for the long haul. And also at the same time, I think I also am very much a person that, and I've said this a number of times to a number of people, I think we live multiple lives within a life. I'm on life two right now. Like this is my second. Actually, I'm probably like trailing towards 2.5. My first life was me as an esthetician. Now I'm in the food world. I probably might be moving into something else soon. I may not even know it. I'm very much an open person that like goes with the flow of life and things that are presented to me. And so funny, I have my shift manager, Hannah. She always jokes with me because, or like she said something the other day because I was just telling her about an interaction that I recently had. And she's like, oh my God, I feel like your life just always falls into place. You know, like when something bad happens, whenever, and I think weirdly enough, I'm at a point in my life now, I've had a number of like very scary things happen to me that I would never wish on anyone. Number of scary things happen to me that I would never wish on anyone. But I think that working through them and getting past them, and sometimes still carrying some of those things with me to this day, but knowing the things that have happened after that, that kind of set me up to succeed. Yeah, I wouldn't be I wouldn't be where I am today without half of the like things in my life that were major fuck ups happening. I remember my parents, two parents who are in academia, having to deal with a child that just got expelled from high school. And it was embarrassing for them. And, you know, I got expelled from high school, but if I had not gotten expelled and gone to another school, I would not have met some of the coolest people that I've known to this day, who would not have inspired me to go into aesthetics. Had I not gone into aesthetics, I don't know what I would be doing right now. And also, I probably wouldn't have gotten to the point where I would have been let down by Red Door to even consider improv, where I met another set of amazing people, or even consider baking as a form of stress release or fun and creativity. I think it's really important to love what you do and give yourself space to grow in that, and also know the difference of when something doesn't serve you any longer. So that's what I mean when I say living multiple lives. When something does become work, and you, even when you step away and you come back and it's still work, or it doesn't excite you like it used to, it's okay to walk away. It's totally fine. I know, I'm pretty sure there are people that when they see me leaving our house, they're gonna be like, what an idiot. I don't care. I'm not doing it for them. I'm doing it for me. And I know that I wasn't meant to stay there forever. It's one of those things where even if it's something that you love and you're doing what you love in a place that you don't necessarily love, if you can't get comfortable, it means you need to be in a bigger space, not even literally speaking for me, but figuratively speaking, it means you're not going to be comfortable. You're not going to be able to grow. It's just like a plant that's put into a pot that's too small. It won't be able to like stretch its roots out and it'll die. You need to be repotted in a bigger plant. So for me, I'm constantly trying to get perspective on my current situation and my overall situation by stepping out of Baltimore a couple of days a month or a day or two a month and going to New York or going to galleries or going just getting out of the kitchen and not baking anything. I think that it's important to give yourself a break from what you love, because then at some point, sometimes when you love something, you can't really tell that you are, when you love something too much, you can't really tell that you're actually doing more harm to yourself than you are good. And that harm for me would be in the form of a burnout, or someone in my line of work, that would be in the form of a burnout. And I don't want to do that. I'm not a nice person when I'm burnout. I'm not fun to be around. I don't want to do anything. I am not going to sit here and act like I don't have anxiety. If you've ever come to Black Sugar and we were closed, I probably had a panic attack and I was just like, I can't come in today. I've worked every day for 12 hours for the past 2 weeks. I can't do it today. I'm not coming in. I think just knowing yourself and knowing your limits are so important to making that transition from doing something you love as a recreation and hobby and doing something you love as a paycheck and as a way of like, as a source of income, and making sure that you have the right people around you to that allow you to, I don't want to say come undone, but allow you to say, I can't do this today. That's really important. That's so important. And not judge you for that and just be like, you know what? I respect that. I'll let you have your time. Call me if you need me kind of thing. Or even people that are like, hey, like, I think you've had your time and you should get back in there. Like, don't be defeated. It's really important to have those types of people in your corner.
Thanks for coming in, Crystal.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Crystal Mack. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. Female Trouble is available everywhere you listen to podcasts and also at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. You can find updates on Twitter at FML Trouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week.